It's Slate Night, the film fan podcast. Now, here are your hosts, Corey and Mason.
Hello and welcome to Slate Night, the film fan podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Mason Schmidt, here with my best bud, Corey Knutson.
Ew!
If you've watched us once, or not, if you haven't watched us at all, don't blame you.
None.
If you haven't watched us, none. We're going to talk about movie news, whether it's new releases that we saw this past week or new releases that are on the horizon. We'll discuss some physical media releases that are coming up this week, as well as some notable developments in the world of movies that we've seen in the past week or so. But first, Corey, we just came off of a Vikings win. We narrowly beat Browns, which is not a great sentence, but we did win. So we came off of that. Corey, how have you been, and what are we drinking today?
Got a little PBR today. Classic. Yeah. Love it. We've been down in these since like 9 a.m.
Tastes like home.
Hey, if you're not wasted, the day is, so... That's what I always say.
On a rainy slash humid Sunday in Minnesota when it's October and it's like 83 degrees outside.
Yeah, too hot for October.
Stupidity, yeah.
Want to issue an apology to anybody that listened to the physical media segment from last week.
Where we talked about Faust, specifically.
Faust and Sunrise. Yeah. And of me just not understanding what was going on, really, as Mason was trying to bring up sort of an interesting thing about Sunrise being one of the first movies to win an Oscar. When we had the discussion of whether it was the first Best Picture winner, blah, blah, blah. The reason it came up is because Mason bought the movie Faust, but I kept referencing the movie Faust and saying random facts about it as Mason's like, nope, we're talking about Sunrise now, this movie that won Oscars, and me just blank look, not understanding what was going on. It was hard to watch through in the edit, but also very funny, as Mason's just like, nope, we're talking about Sunrise now.
Just me trying to politely guide him back to like, come on, just get there. I don't want to yell at you right now. But I talking about that, I do want to bring up Sunrise, because it won a very specific award, and it is kind of a Best Picture winner, but the history books don't acknowledge it as a Best Picture winner, because the award that it technically won, which was like Best Picture of Creative Narrative Filmmaking, and not necessarily the typical Best Picture winner. Sorry to start the episode with this, too, which is, I'm sure, very boring to many people that don't care about a movie that came out almost 100 years ago. But it won a Best Picture Narrative, something like that, but they don't acknowledge that. That award, immediately that next year, was not brought back. It was discontinued, so we only have that Best Picture. But Sunrise, directed by F.W. Murnau, who directed Faust, it did get accolades of that high Academy acknowledgement, so it's like, you kind of won Best Picture, but you didn't, and it's interesting because Wings was like the Best Picture winner of 1929, when they held the first Academy Awards, and Sunrise kind of got like, almost like a, hey, you did something good, but then it's never talked about, and it's kind of like a hidden Best Picture winner that no one really looks at, even though it's not technically a Best Picture. I don't know. It's a Best Picture with a massive asterisk to it, at least for me. So, sorry if you watched that. Corey edited the video and then immediately messaged me to say, oh my god, I'm a fucking idiot. Like, editing this gave me a headache. I'm going to kill myself. So I was just like, oh, I should watch this. And looking at it from the perspective I had, I'm like, it's not that bad. But knowing that you're, like, the one on the receiving end of it, you're like, oh, this is... Yeah, that sucks.
Having to watch myself just do dumb, that, yeah. It really did confirm that I am probably severely autistic.
On the spectrum.
And everyone's just being really nice to me and not telling me that I am.
I have that thought at least like twice a week.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, someone's not telling me I have a lazy eye.
Yeah.
Like, something's going on.
Yeah. There's something wrong with me. And
people are just being nice.
100%.
Like, everyone behind the scenes like walks away and they're like, okay, he's still... Like Truman Show, like, he still doesn't know.
It's really a full make-a-wish thing.
Yeah,
100%. Just really extended for like 25 years.
I feel like most normal people have to have that thought at least once every like month or so.
Yeah.
Whereas you and I, it's like probably 3 to 4 times a week, maybe.
Times a day.
Or times a day. So maybe go to a doctor. Maybe go see someone.
Yeah, maybe I'll try and listen better to what you're actually saying this week.
Even if you knew what I was talking about, it's not worth listening to. Stick around for now.
I'll
drink beer and talk about football and movies mostly.
That's right. Getting into this week, though, we have the big release... which is titled after the thing that Mason called his uncle growing up, the Smashing Machine.
The entire week I was trying to think of a burn that I could levy your way. Oh, fuck you. The Smashing Machine.
This is a remake of a 2002 documentary which chronicles Mark Kerr, who is one of the pioneers of UFC MMA fighting, and... Benny Safdie directed this movie, who was the co-director of Good Time and Uncut Gems with his brother Josh. They have since kind of split up. Josh is bringing out... What's funny over there?
I'm just laughing about your joke again.
Oh, thanks.
Just hit me, second wave of it. Yeah, so shut up.
Run on. Yeah, so Josh is directing Marty Supreme later this year. Benny, his solo directorial debut with The Smashing Machine. And kind of coming into this one, the first thing you have to talk about is Dwayne Johnson being the star of this movie. That's been the thing that's hyped up the most.
Yeah, the conversation surrounding this film has all been about Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
And whether he's going to get an Oscar nomination, that's kind of been all the discussion around it. And to start off there, I want to start off with the positives of this movie, because I think Dwayne Johnson is good in this movie. I think that he gives a good performance. I would say the best performance he's ever given in this movie pretty easily. He's given a lot of fun stuff. We have, you know, Jumanji and Hobbs and Shaw.
Very charismatic, very entertaining, but never like a auteur, or not like something like really dramatic. That's been something that is respectable, I think, to watch.
He's trying to become a thespian now, and I think he does a good job. I think partly it's helped by the incredible makeup and prosthetics work, which I think will not only get nominated for an Oscar, I think it has a really strong chance to win the makeup work in this movie. But Dwayne Johnson's good. I think that he is attempting to go a bit deeper and actually have a better character than just being The Rock in a movie. Yeah. Also, the other performances are good. I think Emily Blunt is good in this movie. I think we'll dive into more of her character a little bit. But I think she herself is good and gives a good performance. The standout for me was Ryan Bader in this movie, who is an MMA fighter in real life. He's never really acted before. And he was great as Mark Coleman, another kind of pioneer of MMA that is featured heavily in this movie. I didn't realize how much his part of the story was here. And like I said last week, I like UFC and MMA. I didn't really know a lot about the history of it. And then with this kind of different group in Japan called Pride, which we spend a lot of time there. But I thought Ryan Bader was great. There's a great scene in a hospital that we talked about before this.
The best scene in the movie.
Yeah, it's just a very raw and authentic thing. He gives a very natural performance. I mean, obviously, because he's not really an actor. But it just, he was kind of in a movie where you're coming in with Dwayne Johnson and Emily Blunt, kind of stole the show for me a little bit. Mm-hmm. A couple other just positives I wanted to throw this movie's way is Benny Safdie's direction, I think, was good. I mean, we knew it from Good Time and Uncut Gems that both of these brothers are very talented. Mm-hmm. And I think the best thing about this movie is that it feels like the late 90s and early 2000s. It really got me in that vibe. The opening scene is kind of like this old school footage of a MMA fight and some wrestling. And then just the rest of the movie with production design and the costumes and everything just really kind of got me into that era. So I think those are the strong elements. We'll dive into what didn't quite work about this movie, but overall, Mason, what did you think of this movie?
I was a bit disappointed by this movie, and I went in with not like sky-high expectations. I feel like a lot of the conversation surrounding this movie prior to it really being released was around the performances, and then that was all you heard about, and when that tends to be the case, it's like, okay, well, so there's nothing really else there story-wise. But I was optimistic just because Benny Safdie, I'm a big fan of the previous Safdie Brothers works that I've seen, especially Uncut Gems. You and I saw that in theaters together. That is one of my favorite movies of probably the last, like, what, that came out in 2019, the last 10 years. So I'm a big fan of Uncut Gems. I'm a big fan of their work as a duo, him stepping out doing his own directorial effort. I figured, like, a lot of that still, that skill would carry over, which it did. But the story itself, which this is a film written and directed by Benny Safdie, I think the writing of this score or of this film is the massive, massive disappointment to me, just because I don't know what this movie was supposed to be about. Even if you look up, like, on IMDb, the synopsis, all that it says is the story of mixed martial arts and UFC champion Mark Kerr. But it's, like, okay, like, kind of. Like, it's pretty vague in that synopsis, but also within the movie, I don't know what this movie's trying to be about. Is it his redemption arc as a fighter after he takes his first loss and how he handles that kind of breakdown of his career? Or is it his opioid addiction that we just kind of stumble upon and then it's a big deal for the middle act of this movie? Or is it his failing, horrible, toxic relationship with Don Staples, played by Emily Blunt, played very well by Emily Blunt, but this just toxic, horrible relationship of two people that are just destined to not be together that are forcing it? Or is it about Mark Coleman, who is literally this stand, like, played by, what, Ryan Bader, mm-hmm. who is the best part of this movie. It feels very much like we're trying to hype up UFC, mixed martial arts, and the kind of the spearheads of that sport. But also, I don't know what our perspective is supposed to be on. What are we supposed to get from this movie? It doesn't feel like it has a clear, defined perspective or purpose in the story that it's trying to tell. It just feels so scatterbrained. And while I think aesthetically it looks really good and it looks authentic to the late 90s, it is filmed relatively well. I will say, for a mixed martial arts film, the combat sequences, the sequences in the arena or in the ring were lackluster to me. I didn't take really much away from those fights. The best fighting in this film takes place with Dwayne The Rock Johnson punching a fucking door, which you see in the trailers, and he does it a couple times in this movie. The best sparring you see is between him and Emily Blunt in their relationship drama. But also, I don't care about these characters because they're both kind of in the wrong, and I see where they're coming from, but also I don't care about it. And there's moments where one of them is being toxic towards the other, and I'm like, well, yeah, I'm on this character's side. And then it just kind of switches back and forth, and I'm like, you guys are just wrong for each other. And I feel like this film had a very muddled vision. Whether I think it's well-directed or not, aesthetically, the way it looks, yeah, that's great. The performances are good, but this movie was a drag to watch. Also, when it ended, I was like, that's it? Like, that's... What impact was I supposed to have as the viewer leaving this theater today? Like, I didn't think I had something that, like, oh, yeah, that's the point of this movie. Oh, yeah, never give up. Or, oh, yeah, push against the limits. Or, hey, we all have our limits, and we need to accept that, and we need to grow as a person outside of those limits that we are hesitant to accept. I don't fucking know what this movie was about. Like, I'm like, what? We're getting, like, three distinct different stories about that kind of, like, circle around Mark Kerr, but I'm like... What was the purpose of this?
It feels very much like there's a lot of individual elements I like to it, but it is very scattershot, like you said. There's a lot of just kind of... It's weirdly like almost a hangout movie in parts where it's just kind of like showing you a snapshot of his life, and it feels like we're missing the in-between moments. It's also very interesting where we jump into the movie, because we start out... in, I think it's 97, maybe. Yeah. And we see him, like, doing some wrestling, and then we kind of jump forward a bit, and we see him in Japan doing this whole Pride tournament, which is the crux of the movie. Mm. But it feels like it doesn't really commit to anything.
Yeah.
It sort of wants to touch on the opioid stuff, on the relationship stuff, on the Mark Coleman relationship and his friend, which all, like, that was the most interesting thing to me, was, like, them... you know, Mark Coleman being his trainer and friend, and then they kind of become rivals in this tournament. Yeah. That's the most compelling thing for me. And then it's, you know, the fighting isn't, like, all that great. Like, visually, it's not that exciting. And I just never felt the motivations of, like, why does Mark Kerr love to fight?
Yeah.
Why did he initially get addicted to opioids? Why did he get in this toxic relationship, and why is he staying in this relationship? Why does Emily Blunt want to stay in this relationship as Don? Like, they're just kind of surface-level characters. We don't go that deep with them. And it feels weird because it doesn't really follow the formula of a typical sports movie.
Yeah.
Which I think it could have used some of that guidance a little bit. Because I think you can either do that stereotypical sports movie and kind of cover, like, somebody's whole life where you start from beginning to end and show that. Or, like, beginning to, like, a very important moment in their life. Or you can do... the biopic thing of, like, what A Complete Unknown did last year, where you focus on a very specific set of years and, like, a very specific character arc for this person with, like, Bob Dylan
and
last year.
And you find
year.
A way to tell that entire story of that person within this moment or within these events.
Yes. And it feels like that's what, you know, the Springsteen movie is kind of doing with, like, one album that Bruce Springsteen's doing. And it feels like this movie kind of had a weird in-between where it didn't really do either of those things. It is set within a few set of years, but... I never got a full grasp of, like, why this character is the way that they is, or what is the way that they are. And I never felt, like, Mark Kerr is obviously a big a trailblazer, a pioneer of UFC and MMA. You don't really feel that impact in this movie. And they mention a lot that he's undefeated in this movie, and you never feel like, oh, this guy's, like, on top of the world. This guy is, like, one of the best.
We see his, like, first fight, which turns into, like, an ongoing tournament within a day where he fights, like, back to back to back. And, yeah, he builds up this kind of, like, undefeated thing, but we've only seen that first day of him fighting, and now we cut to, oh, he's this big, prolific, undefeated fighter. It's like, I don't buy into it. Like, where are we? Also, this film takes massive, like, time jumps. and they don't, which I'm fine with, and I'm fine with them not 100% disclosing the jumps, but sometimes it just muddled the story beyond what I think they were trying to do, and it just felt like the story that they were trying to tell was sloppy. What it feels like is that the true life story that this is based on isn't as interesting as I think Benny Safdie believes it to be. I think that Benny Safdie has some sort of passion, obviously, to tell a story about Mark Kerr and has some sort of connection to this story, whether it's nostalgia or whether there's a deep admiration there, whatever. I don't think that the true life events really equates or lines up to becoming a very interesting and investing narrative, at least within this film. I was bored for large bouts of this movie. It's 2 hours, and I think, I don't know, maybe 30 minutes of this movie, I was like solidly entertained. And you referenced that one scene that for me was the best scene in the movie is between Ryan Bader and Dwayne Johnson. Dwayne Johnson does give a great performance, and that I get that kind of high praise that this film has gotten. But Dwayne Johnson, Ryan Bader, where he's in a hospital bed, and I'm going to spoil this lightly because it is the best part of the movie, and it is the only part of this movie I would think is worth seeing in theaters. But he, after his kind of falling out of his loss, his opioid addiction, he's been passing out, like he's not doing well health-wise, and Ryan Bader gets a call from Don, comes across country, comes and sees Mark Kerr in the hospital, and he's like, hey, just tell me what's going on. Tell me your side of the story. What happened? And he's like, Mark Kerr's feeding him this bullshit story of what lined up, what ended up him being in this hospital, what resulted in him being in this hospital bed right now. And it's a bullshit story, and as the viewer, you can see him kind of deflecting and hiding away the truths of it. And then Ryan Bader, as Mark Coleman's like, stop it. Like, I see what you're doing. Stop it. Like, what? And then that is the best moment of the movie. And the biggest takeaway is just that brothership that kind of forms between Coleman and Kerr in this movie. But other than that, I don't think that there is a really valiant effort at a through line within these kind of story elements, because you think, oh wow, it's going to lead up to this big climactic thing where this guy who got Mark Kerr into fighting is going to be the one that they go head to head in the finals. Well, that didn't happen. Kerr got bounced by some schlubby Asian guy. Like, also, that is a big negative I have in this movie. Dwayne Johnson, your size is going to somewhat hinder you in the types of roles that you're able to take on where it's believable or where it's not a distraction, I feel like. And I get that. And in this movie, you got cast in the perfect role of playing Mark Kerr, a guy who's a hulking, massive man who is dominant in the ring, and it works. But there are some times when Mark Kerr I get the size of a fighter isn't always the biggest thing in a fight, but Mark Kerr, Dwayne Johnson, goes into a ring, and he's fighting a dude that's built like me, just a little bit more of a beer gut and maybe longer arms, and he's getting tossed by him? I don't buy that one for 1 second. There's so much suspension of disbelief within watching this film for me where I was like, fuck this. Like, it felt like they tried so hard on the aesthetics, the casting. I feel like they really, like, bunted on the writing and on the believability of the casting. And I think that this film, all in all, was like, and I'm saying this as someone who is like, it's fine. I think that this was a massive misfire for me and was a very frustrating watch for me, only because I'm like, this could have been, like, if you change this, this could have been better. And you change this or fix this, this could have been better. And I'm like, it's more frustrating because this movie, I feel like, had more potential to being something great, and it just middled out. It just spiraled out and just landed in this kind of purgatory of, it's okay.
I 100% agree. I think it's a very fine movie. I maybe enjoyed it a little bit more. I like sports dramas in general, so it kind of worked for me in some scenes. Him, like, training and getting ready and running some steps.
Yeah,
so
I'm kind of like, you get a little montage, yeah.
And I love that they included the song My Way by Frank Sinatra. Yeah. It was in the trailer, and I hate when movies put a great song in a trailer and then don't bring it into the movie, but they actually used it in the movie, which was fun. But yeah, this very much like the parts, some parts are great, but just overall as a whole didn't come together. And I think just in terms of Oscar conversation, I kind of mentioned the makeup and hairstyling. I think that will get nominated. I feel pretty strongly about that. But if Dwayne Johnson gets nominated for an Oscar for best actor, I'll be fine. I think that's deserving. If he doesn't, I won't be surprised. And that's kind of the, it's interesting, like, starting September in the fall time, you hear about all these performances and movies,
yeah,
and once you actually see them, it starts to take shape a little bit, and you're like, eh, okay, like, this isn't as good as people were hyping it up to be,
yeah,
as a 15-minute standing ovation at Venice, which
any ovation at Venice is, like, you hear about it for every fucking movie. They're just a bunch of dumb idiots that are excited to see a movie, and they're like, oh, they're here, we need to hype them up, and it's just, they all neutralize each other just because they all get ovations. And this movie doesn't deserve a 15-minute standing ovation. This movie, I quickly went to the door, went to the exit as soon as the credits started rolling, and I feel like that's a more accurate representation as to the quality of this movie. Not that it's ass, but it's just 15 minutes. Come on, you're going to stand up there and clap. How do you clap for 15 minutes to celebrate a fucking movie? And I love movies, but, like, come on.
Yeah, it's very fine. If you're a big fan of UFC and MMA, I mean, I feel like I've heard people say the documentary is very good, and I think that's where this kind of works better in terms of telling that story. But if you want a good MMA movie, watch Warrior. I think that movie has a great combination of awesome, like, action fight scenes and character work. Yeah. McNulty's great in that movie, so this one is a little bit disappointing from both of us, and, you know, it may pop up in award season in, like, a couple of categories, but it's not going to be in any of the major ones.
Kind of similar to what you said. I'd be honestly really thrilled if Dwayne Johnson got a nomination, just because I've grown up with Dwayne Johnson. Obviously, I watched him as a wrestler, but also in movies, he's just, like, I feel like it's cool to see such a shift in a line of work from being an entertainer and a WWE superstar into an actor and hopefully eventually a thespian actor. So I dug him in this movie. I do think he is probably the best part of this movie. The makeup, like you mentioned, is something that's really interesting, because in every scene, I'm like, what is it that they changed about him? It's got to be about his brow, his eyes, his hair, obviously, his nose. Like, what did they change? Like, it works and it's seamless. I think that this performance does fall into, like, it's checking all the boxes for what a try-hard Oscar push for a performance would be, of based on a true character. You relied on makeup and prosthetics, and you have a couple of those very heavy, loud, emotional scenes, and he checks all those boxes, and he's good in all of those scenes, but it's just like, if he doesn't, I wouldn't be surprised. If he does, I'd be thrilled for him. So it's not a resounding win for this movie. I'm still excited to see whatever Safdie Brothers or Safdie Solo directed films that we have to come, especially Marty Supreme. That trailer did show in front of the Smashing Machine for me, and I was like, that's kind of cool to see a brother tee up a brother in terms of the trailers before a movie. So I can't really recommend the Smashing Machine that much, but I do think there are some nuggets of positivity to have within this sports film.
I'm excited to see Dwayne Johnson. I think he's in the Scorsese movie coming out in a couple of years, with Emily Blunt, I think, is also in
and
it. So
maybe Leo or something like that. There are so many different, like, Scorsese projects that I'm like, which one's happening first?
Right.
Like, he's like, this one too. And I'm like, dude, you're getting up there in age. Like, you should prioritize which one specifically you want to make.
This feels like it could be a good bridge for him, where it's like a little bit of familiar territory with like wrestling and fighting, and kind of also a bit of acting too, and kind of getting him into that if he does continue wanting to act in a bit more serious projects.
Well, then he's slimmed down a little bit too, so I'm like, are you trying to kind of bleed into more of, like, an everyman? For those who are listening to the podcast, I'm doing air quotations, like, an everyman. Like, yeah, you're still built like Dwayne Johnson, but, like, an everyman type role, where Mark Kerr, he's not the everyman, he's a big dude, and Dwayne Johnson can play that, but I'm like, are you trying to kind of lose yourself a little bit more in a role? And I'm here for it if he does, because I think he was good in this movie, but it remains to be seen. And whenever that Martin Scorsese movie, whatever it is, whenever it comes out, I'm excited to see it, especially if Dwayne Johnson's one of the leads in it. In other kind of news, in terms of the big releases from this past week, one of the smaller releases that I feel like, once that first initial, like, announcement trailer or trailer highlighting what the main perspective of this movie was, it immediately, at least for me, skyrocketed it into, like, I should probably see this movie in theaters. It's going to be something kind of cool and inventive. But Good Boy came out this past week. It is the horror film shot from the perspective of a dog, or viewed through the eyes of the dog. It's directed by Ben Leonberg, or Leoberg, or whatever the fuck it's going to see. Whatever I say it's going to be the exact opposite when I hear it in an interview later, so it doesn't matter. This is starring Indy the dog, which a dog named Indy. That is fucking perfection. Love that.
Indiana. After the dog. The dog.
And we got Shane Jensen and Ariel Friedman. It's a very small cast. I saw this movie back on Thursday night. It's about a dog who moves into a rural family home with his owner and only discovered supernatural forces kind of lurking throughout the home. It is the owner's grandfather's home. It's a home that's been passed around throughout their family for many generations. So it's just, it has this legacy to it. The owner isn't in the best of health, so he decides, you know what, I need a break from my everyday life. I'm going to move out to the woods. And then we get kind of a formulaic, generic horror movie, but told through the perspective, or seen through the perspective of the dog, Indy, which, damn, Indy gives a solid performance in this movie, which, like, I'm kind of joking in tone, but, like, also being dead-ass serious. Like, the dog is really good in this, and it makes me kind of sad. I'm like, what did the dog think was happening? Like, did the dog think that this was a movie, or was the dog actually genuinely terrified in scenes? I don't know. I don't know much about the making of. That's something I'd be really interested to see, actually, after seeing this movie, is how long did it take them to film something like this? How do you get a dog to be trained and give a reaction to a thing within a story that is realistic without it being like, oh no, you guys just genuinely terrified a fucking dog on screen. So, this movie, I feel like that perspective was the kind of gimmick in terms of selling this movie and making people to go see it. I went to go see it because I'm a big horror fan. Also, it came out at a great time in being the first week of October here. I didn't love this movie because while, yes, you do have a really interesting and potentially investing perspective, a perspective that I feel like most sane human beings, if they see a dog in a movie, they're like, I hope the dog is okay. I hope the dog makes it out all right. And you love dogs. If you're a warm-blooded male or a warm-blooded female, or you're a human being, you want to see something good happen, you're rooting for the dog in this movie. Which, thankfully, the director came out and was like, yeah, guys, don't worry, the dog lives, it's fine. And the dog does live, spoiler alert. But this film surrounding this dog and the Oscar Academy potential performance of this dog... the movie is very bland. It's very generic. There are no solid scares, and a lot of the beats that it relies on surround jump scares. And the main entity that is haunting this house is very bland and formulaic. So it's an hour and 13 minute movie with a dog as the star of the movie. And the dog is exceptional. I get the perspective they're doing. It's very much the way I thought of Presence from earlier this year, directed by Steven Soderbergh, where you get a cool perspective on things, of somewhat of a formulaic haunting story, but you're getting a perspective of the ghost. Oh, cool. And then you come to realize that the perspective within that movie is the only good part of the movie, or at least the only selling point of the movie. Otherwise, it's a pretty generic kind of meh thing. And that's kind of the same for Good Boy. The perspective of the dog, the inventiveness of the way that they're able to shoot things and capture things with the dog really worked well. But overall, the story around us is like, it's an hour and 13. This movie feels like an hour and a half. Like, I'm getting bored. Like, come on. What's happening? Give me something solid. Give me something scary. You don't get it in this movie. So, while it's a cool attempt, and it's cool what they're able to do, there's not a lot here for me to really recommend this to you. Are you going to try and check this out in theaters?
I don't know if I'll do it in theaters, but I do want to see it eventually. I know last week I mentioned when we talked about it coming out, kind of Skinamarink as a comparison.
Yep.
Would you say it's kind of similar in a way?
I like Skinamarink more. Skinamarink was more unsettling.
Okay.
Like, while that is kind of a gimmicky, weird kind of the way it's filmed, and it has like this weird nostalgic thing to it, which is just like the film. I don't know. Skinamarink, I think, overall worked more and was more effective. Whereas this just, once you get, like, you get into the movie, you get 10 minutes into it, and you're like, wow, this is a dog. We're following the dog. That's really cool. Once you get past that, there's nothing else to really support you staying in the theater after that point. Mm-hmm. So Skinamarink was like at least consistently something unique that surprised me and was like, while I don't love that movie, it's a very eerie and
some freaky
stuff, and it works and it's very effective. Whereas this, I'm like, it kind of runs out of steam pretty quickly after you're like, all right, well, cool. Yeah, we're following the dog. Oh, that was it. That's all you guys had. Oh, okay, sweet. You showed your hand. So Skinamarink is better. I like Skinamarink
more. Okay. Yeah, like I said, I haven't seen this one yet, but it did get me thinking about my favorite dogs in movies. Which there's some obvious Air Buds and Beethoven.
Old Yeller.
Old Yeller. It's all kind of that.
Sad fucking thing to watch in school.
I was kind of want to think of like some lesser ones. One that I thought about was, John Wick's dog, not the initial one that dies sadly, but the pit bull that he gets at the end shows up in the rest that teams up for some fucking kills is sweet. Also, I think my favorite dog in the movie is Einstein from Back to the Future, who is just experiencing people coming in and out of time and trying to figure out what's going on, of like knowing his owner, but they don't know him in this timeline. I love Einstein. He's great. So, I don't know. I just wanted to shout out a couple movie dogs that I really love. I think
this one's iconic, so it's kind of a cheat, but the, like, the Mastiff in Sandlot, the Beast.
Oh, yeah, nice.
That is such a character, like, yeah, plot point in that movie, and it serves the story so well. And I think, I think Mastiffs are really cute dogs, but also I think it's held, or, like, it's stood the test of time, and it's also a really good point, or, like, conflict for those characters in Sandlot. So I think he might be my favorite dog off the top of my head.
Love it. That's a good one, too. I caught up on a movie that came out last week, which is The Strangers Chapter 2. Obviously a follow-up to The Strangers Chapter 1, but also the fourth, The Strangers Chapter 2 is the fourth Strangers movie. It's a franchise now. It doesn't need to be. Because this movie is very bad. It's not good at all. I think I mentioned that the first original Strangers is kind of nostalgic for me and my family. We grew up watching it. I saw The Strangers Chapter 1 with my mom last year, and I actually went over to her place this past weekend, just watching some football, having dinner, whatever. And I was like, "Do you want to go see a movie? Do you want to see The Strangers Chapter 2?" And she's like, "Eh, I don't know." Even coming, like, I feel like our moms are sort of in a space where like any movie is like pretty good or okay.
Yeah, like
walking out of Strangers Chapter 1 last year, she's like, "I didn't really care for that." And I'm like, "That's saying something right now." And The Strangers Chapter 2 is more the same. It's very bland and uninteresting characters. This movie is directed by Rennie Harlan. He filmed these first two movies, and I guess a third one, all at the same time. And he really, I don't know what his goal is with these movies, or like why he was so passionate about the Strangers franchise.
Piss people off.
Maybe. But this second movie feels like a filler movie so much. It picks up right where the first one left off. The main girl, played by Madeline Petch, is in the hospital. And you get some Halloween 2 stuff in there, which is never exciting at all. You get a middle portion that's in the woods, and then you get a third section that's kind of in a house. And there's just nothing that happens. There's no story to this movie. And the worst thing that they do here is, like, trying to deconstruct the Strangers. Which, we talked about the great line of, like, we did it because you were home. Like, yeah, we broke in and terrorized you because you were here. That's terrifying.
It's the best part of why they're the Strangers.
They're strangers. You don't need to dive into them, really. With some characters, I want to dive into them. Yeah. This one, I'm like, no, they're just doing it because this should have just been one movie in 2008 or whenever it came out. This movie has weird flashbacks that show the Strangers as kids that are just showing just laughable things that are happening. There's a middle portion of this movie where the main girl's in the woods, and she gets attacked by a boar, and it's a fucking wild sequence of a boar opening the trunk to a car, getting through to the front seat, ripping her leg apart, and then she's running, like, a little bit later. I guess her leg is fine.
Yeah.
It's just, like, rinse and repeat
putting
of, like,
all NFL quarterbacks or running backs to shame with her ability to walk off an industry or an injury.
Yeah, it's just, like, it's so just rinse and repeat of the person's hiding and the Strangers are walking by, and then the little noise gets made, and then they notice them, and it's just like they do that over and over and over and over again. This movie is not good at all. They have a mid-credits scene in of a trailer for the third movie, and they show, spoiler alert for this, I guess, they show that the main girl is maybe going to join the Strangers in the third one, which, like, there is some interesting things you could do there. But we've had two movies to sit through of dog shit, of generic horror shit that I didn't like. So this one I did not enjoy. Can't recommend it. The only thing that saves it is, I guess, being in October where I'm like, yeah, I want some horror movies, but it's not good. Just watch the original Strangers because it's a very solid movie.
Yeah, I've only ever seen that original Strangers movie, and that is still a bone-chilling horror film that I can't watch with my wife, because she's like, any movie where a bad person does bad things and they're just a human being set out to fuck people up, it's scary to her, and I get that. It's believable. And to not have a deeper understanding of who that person is that's doing it, they just did it because they did it. They said, fuck it, why not? that scary. Mm-hmm. I have no desire to watch these. Rennie Harlan Strangers, this new trilogy. It, from your describing of it, it sounds like the most recent attempt at the Halloween trilogy of Halloween 2018, Halloween Kills, and Halloween Ends. I like those movies. I acknowledge they're not good. 2018's fine.
Yeah.
But after that, they're not good movies. I still really like them because I love Michael Myers and I have a lot of nostalgia for the franchise. And I know you don't like them and you hate Corey Cunningham, which I'm not going to put as a slight to you because, like, I think the broad appeal or broad...
I like Halloween 2018. I actually really enjoy
that one's good. Yeah, yeah. There's some missteps in that and there's a lot of missteps that carry on throughout that.
Those... Kills and Ends are dog shit.
I still really like those movies. Dog shit. They're not great, but I like them. This feels like the way you're describing the Strangers, at least these first two chapters before we get the capper, what, is that coming out next year?
I guess so. I don't know. Sure.
Everyone's so anticipating that.
Yeah.
It feels like a lot of these creatives are like, I have this somewhat kind of love and nostalgia towards this franchise. Let's bring it back. But they have ideas for like the beginning and the end of it. And then the middle chapter is just like, well, we'll fill it in. We'll just connect the dots 100%. Somehow. Because, like, I like Halloween Kills, but it's very much just, like, how do we get Jamie Lee Curtis against Michael Myers again? How do we want to bring back Michael Myers, and we want Jamie Lee Curtis to kill Michael Myers. How do we get there? We got to create that you. The bottom part of the you, the bottom part, the worst part is Act 2, which, for me, Halloween Kills is the lesser of the two of or lesser of the three of the new Halloween trilogy. And it sounds like Stranger Chapter 2 is just trying to fucking carry on the story somehow to get them to where they want the story to end, but they didn't have like a logical kind of plot or path to get us there. So I haven't watched these films aside from the first one and aside from the pool scene of Strangers Pray at Night.
Good scene.
I've seen that because I heard it was good.
Yeah.
But everything else I've heard is kind of dog shit, so I've avoided it like the plague. Not surprised by this, but that's the hook of this is its timing and its release. You release a horror movie in like September, October, you might get me into theaters.
Couple extra points.
Yeah, you might get me into theaters. So, like, I haven't seen Stranger Chapter 1. I could see myself on, like, a fucking Wednesday just like, I'm going to go see Stranger Chapter 2. Why not? What do I have to lose? And then just get pissed about it. But see a horror movie. So, because I love horror. Mm-hmm. But I'm not surprised that you had this reaction to this movie, as I feel like most of the critical reception surrounding this has been massively negative. But
the Stranger Chapter 1 somehow is a little bit better than Chapter 2.
I've seen some of the inverse of that. I've seen some people being like, it's a step up from the first one. And I'm like, I don't know if that's like the biggest positive to be like, well, it's still bad, but it's a little bit better than like dog shit or vice versa. So doesn't sound like it has great trajectory regardless. But a horror movie that you talked about last week, or a horror thriller that you talked about last week, that I feel like kind of got maybe a kind of poor reception that wasn't necessarily the most deserved, was The Woman in the Yard, directed by Wame Coulette Serra, which is a director, weirdly enough, we talk about a lot on this podcast, just because I don't think he's really missed. He hasn't given me, like, fantastic movies across the board, but I don't think he's missed. He's given me good times at the theaters, engaging thrillers, the best shark movie since Jaws with The Shallows.
Mm-hmm.
But he did The Woman in the Yard, starring Danielle Deadwyler, which she's easily becoming one of my favorite new actresses or new actresses that I'm being able to see more of. This is a little thriller from earlier this year that I didn't see in theaters that, after your recommendation, after you seeing it last week, I went and watched this week, and I thoroughly enjoyed this movie. I was really surprised. It's very brisk. It's like an hour... Sorry, that started as a burp in my mouth.
The hell?
I
was like, God damn.
Shut up. This movie is like about an hour and a half, and it's very brisk. Like, it flies by. There's not like the most amount of like shattering scares or scares that really rock you. And that's fine. I've kind of come to expect that, at least with, I think this movie might have been PG-13. With like PG-13 horror, it's going to be a lot of like jump scares and tension and a lot of relying on the score to really get you there. There are moments like that in this movie. I'm not going to act like there isn't. But I think the story that it's trying to tell of a woman that's trying to kind of regather and fix her life post losing her husband, now having two young children, in a farmhouse that her husband was going to revamp, rebuild, and renovate. And now she's just kind of stuck in a life that she didn't really want with two kids that are kind of giving her a hard time, and she misses her husband. And I'm like, oh, okay. Immediately you set the stage. This is a good jumping off point. And then, boom, you have A Woman in the Yard. That is such a good horror premise. Mm-hmm. It works so well in this movie. It's not a premise that's going to last like a 2.5 hour long runtime, but for an hour and a half for what they're setting out to do, it works. I really like this film as a thriller. It gets really trippy. I think that they commit to really big character things of like, well, what if this is this, what does this mean? And what if we looked at this story through a different perspective? And what if the husband didn't die? What if he was still around? What is that world like? And I think there's a lot of cool kind of like conversations of revolving around grief and how you could like how a person reevaluates things and like, well, what if this didn't happen? What if this went this way? And you get that in this movie, and it was kind of refreshing to see that, of just a woman being fed up with her place in the world, being fed up with her current state, and being like, fuck it, what if this happened? And we get to see that play out a little bit, and we get to see kind of that dynamic with her kids, and especially her late husband. And I really enjoyed this movie. I would say not really, there wasn't really a scare in here that really landed necessarily for me. As a thriller, it works. As a horror movie, I don't think it really does for me. The ending of this movie, which you brought up last week, not that it saves the movie, not that this movie needed saving, but the ending of this movie is so much better than this movie really deserves. And it really just like tied the bow on a very pretty good thriller that I wasn't expecting. So The Woman in the Yard, it hasn't gotten great reviews. Every review I looked up, because I was like, well, what did Jeremy John say about this? What did Chris Stuckman say about this? What did Dan Merle say about this? I couldn't find reviews, and I saw all of these like other clickbaity YouTube reviews saying Blumhouse's worst horror movie, their newest and dog shit horror movie. And I'm just like, it's not bad. No. Like, it's a good movie. It's not the best movie of all time. It's not the most effective horror film, but it's a pretty good movie. Mm-hmm. Of the movies I watched this week, it's towards the top of the list, and that includes The Smashing Machine and Good Boy. So, like, I don't think that this movie was a complete miss. If anything, I think we didn't, like, really shell out for a movie that really deserves some more recognition for the things that it does well. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, this was a good little quiet thriller that I missed from this year that I was really happy to kind of, with it being October, go back and revisit, or visit for the first time.
I'm glad that we've both gotten a chance to watch it the past couple weeks, because it easily is one that could have just been like, yeah, I don't know, let it slip. It's one from this year, whatever. But yeah, I think, I mean, I agree. I don't want to spoil the ending, but we were kind of talking about just our kind of interpretations about it and just what other people have been saying online about it, what they think was happening, the whole movie, which is cool. I think I mentioned last week, like, scenes in the attic where it kind of reframes.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really cool because you see, like, from a child's perspective of something happening, and then it gets flipped a little bit later and you see that same thing happening, which I think that's just another element that kind of elevates it a bit.
Yeah.
So, a solid movie for sure. Check it out if you want a good horror movie this October. Just kind of get you in the mood. A movie that I checked out from 2022 is Fresh, which is directed by Mimi Cave and stars Daisy Edgar Jones and Sebastian Stan. This is a Hulu original movie as Mason switches from a Vikings hat to a Chargers hat.
So I did bring this just in case that the Vikings shit the bed and lost to the Browns. But I was wearing this originally when I bought this. I bought this in person, so the stupidity is all on me. I bought a small/medium fitted cap. I have a large head. A large head to the point where my wife is like, I'm not excited to have your kids because it's going to hurt me. And I get that. That's fine. Whatever. But I accidentally bought a small/medium hat, and then I have since buying it cut a lot of slits in the fitted part of the elastic to try and elongate it and stretch around my big fucking melon. It's not working. So I brought a Chargers hat that I was going to wear if the Vikings shit the bed, but also this is a medium large, whereas this is a small medium. This fits me better. This is giving me a headache, so I switched.
I've got to go with like the trucker style hats.
Trucker style hats are so much better.
It's just I got to adjust, and like some fit differently than others, so I don't know. Anyways.
So I'm wearing a Vikings shirt and a Chargers hat. Two of my favorite teams, but together this just is stupid as shit. So sorry about that, but I was getting a headache from that hat.
So I watched Fresh this week.
Perfect transition.
Getting back to that.
Yeah.
Daisy Edgar Jones, Sebastian Stan came out on Hulu in 2022, like I said. And basically, Daisy Edgar Jones is a single woman who's trying to go out on all these dates on dating apps and find somebody. And she meets Sebastian Stan. They go out to his house. And weird stuff starts to happen. I am going to talk spoilers. The movie's been out for a couple years now. If you don't want to know anything, go check it out. It's a very solid thriller. That's what I'll say before getting into spoilers. It's a fun thriller. It's not like a very scary movie at all, but
yeah,
just a fun performances and everything. And basically, the crux of this movie is that Sebastian Stan is basically capturing women, and he's a cannibal, and he's cutting up their bodies and selling them to people that want to eat human beings, the other cannibals. There's a market for that, which, scarily enough, there's probably that in real life, too. I would not doubt it, which is terrifying.
Not digging into that.
Yeah, that's a very awful thing to think about, but... Sebastian Stan, I want to start out there because he's having so much fun in this role. Like, I've heard that he was a lot of fun in this movie, and like I've seen like some of the dances that he does in this movie. But just in the last few years, I've loved seeing Sebastian Stan kind of break out of the MCU Bucky, which we love Bucky, he's great, yeah. And Thunderbolts was one of his best performances as Bucky, but seeing him in this movie and in The Apprentice and A Different Man, just different really man. Doing a lot of different stuff, I love, because I think he's a really good actor. And he's just chewing up scenery here. And it has a very playful kind of vibe to it when he's, like, chopping up different parts of somebody. He's, like, playing music, dancing around, just, like, chopping up limbs.
A little Patrick Bateman kind
of? A little bit, yeah, a little bit. And he's really giving it his all. He's having a great time. Daisy Edgar Jones is great. I loved her in Twisters. I thought she was good. I've heard she's really solid in Normal People, that show with Paul Mescal.
Yeah, I've heard about that too.
And I think she's kind of a rising star in Hollywood. And those two, their conversations that they have once they kind of get to this house, and she is trapped and, you know, she's chained up and everything there, and she's kind of playing games with him of acting like she's liking it, and she's being like, oh, like, you know, how did you get into this, and all this type of weird shit, where she's trying to keep him happy, you know, to not get killed right away. They have a few dinner scenes that are really, really interesting, and great performances from both of them. So I enjoyed that a lot. I think this movie does have some fun commentary on the current dating scene of dating apps, which, you know, Tinder and Bumble and all the other things are just a fucking hellscape sometimes.
I mean, Hinge was pretty decent for me when I was single. I liked Hinge.
There's Hinge. Hinge is all right. Yeah, there's so many apps. And there's a date between Daisy Edgar Jones and another guy, like, early on in the movie, where he's just like, oh, I don't... This place is only cash. I don't have cash. Can you pay for it? Also, my weird little scarf is in the sauce, and I'm really upset about it. Also, kind of pissed that you don't want to, like, make out after the date. Like, you're a fucking bitch. I didn't even like you anyways on this date. A lot of things.
You can't fire me. I quit, actually. Yeah.
So, a lot of commentary there about it. And there's, like, the final scene of the movie kind of plays back into that. So, fun commentary on dating. I think it's a very solid thriller. I enjoy it. I think that it does reveal the twist a little bit too early of Sebastian Stan being a cannibal and what he's doing. Because then the rest of the movie loses a little bit of steam. You're kind of just waiting for them to, like, break out the other, like, captors there, or people that are held captive. Yeah. So I think that it could have held that reveal a little bit later. But overall, very solid. There is a side character in this movie. It's a bartender that's, like, a friend of a friend of a friend that has no point of this movie. Like, he's kind of investigating, like, where these people are, and, like, finds their location on his phone, and then he goes there, and then he's like, I don't actually want to fuck with this. So then
he's like Lil Rel Howery from Get Out.
Except he doesn't do anything, and leaves before. It's almost like that, where he pulls up in his car, hears a gunshot, and he's like, nope, I'm gonna leave. And serves no purpose, and it added, like, another 10 to 15 minutes in this movie.
That is me in any horror movie. If anything bad is going down that I'm suspicious of, I'm going to look into it. But once I see that shit's going down, I'm like, you know what? I should have looked into this. I'm leaving, actually.
Pretty much what happened here. So just, like, a little bit could have been, you know, carved out of the runtime there. But overall, very solid. I'm enjoyed. I'm happy I watched it, because I think the performances are good. Fun little concept, and everybody's having a good time in the movie. Along with some fun, you know, stuff to say about modern dating. So, would recommend. It's on Hulu right now. It's been on there for the last 3 years, and been catching up on it. So, it was a fun little Halloween October watch.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I've heard nothing but good things. I feel like the way it was sold to me was it being a movie about cannibalism, which is weird that the film then kind of tries to keep it in the pocket a little bit of, like, not revealing that to the audience, when the audience is maybe in the know on it. But it's a film I've always been interested in. Sebastian Stan, I think, of, like, a lot of the... Even, the A-tier, B-tier MCU characters, I think, of the actors, Sebastian Stan, I feel like, can have a really great acting career outside of the MCU, and I'm really excited just because I did really like A Different Man, and I feel like I could probably really like this movie, so I'll maybe check that out this October as I'm trying to collect a lot of different horror movies that I haven't seen before as I get through this month. The movie I talked about last week, which we also started with at the top of this episode of correcting history of Faust.
No Oscar nominations for Faust.
No Oscar nominations for Faust. But it is directed by F.W. Murnau, who made Sunrise, also made Nosferatu. So you get a lot of that kind of like gothic horror within this film. I did watch the movie this past week. It's an hour and 47 minutes long. It is from 1926, and it's a silent film. Take that the way that you would. Like this, watching silent films is not similar to watching, obviously, a present day movie. It's a completely different viewing experience. And I was telling Corey this before we started recording, of when you watch a silent movie, there's going to be downtime in it, regardless of how long the movie is. It could be 20 minutes. There's going to be like 5 minutes of downtime of like, what's fucking happening? Oh, it's just like people on screen just to be entertaining. Fine, whatever. And this film does have aspects of this where I'm like, we're getting a little long in the tooth here, but it's still engaging enough. It's hard to really sell a movie like this to a kind of more average movie viewer or movie fan. But the thing that really sold me on this movie was a clip I saw on Instagram of just a shot of this movie. It's from 1926, and this is some of the best black and white imagery I've ever seen put to film. It's a story that centers around this demon, Mephisto, not the MCU Mephisto played by Sacha Baron Cohen, a different Mephisto. This demon making a wager with either an archangel or God, saying like, hey, if I can corrupt this alchemist, this man named Faust, this mortal man, this man that you and I can both agree is good, if I can corrupt him, then I get to lay waste to the world and have my run with things. And the archangel's just like, sure. It's like, okay. So immediately Mephisto, this demon, is like, I'm going to enact plagues. I'm gonna make people starve. People are going to die of illness. And like, all this shit's happening. He's just trying to corrupt this man, this alchemist. And it's a movie about the human spirit and about morality and being good. And story aside, it's such a visually arresting thing to watch. It's hard to say it's a film just because it's something from almost 100 years ago. And yeah, there's a narrative, but it's more of just like what you see on screen. And it really works. It's always fun and very investing and interesting to watch a movie that's this old, just because it's like, how the fuck did they make that? How did they film that? It's just made by a bunch of guys in a tent in the dark, trying to make sure that the sun or the film doesn't get exposed to the light and completely fry the image. And I'm like, this looks so good still today. So I'm not gonna go on too long about this movie because it's from 1926. I'm sure many of the listeners don't know about this movie, aren't that interested, and I don't blame you. But as someone who loves movies, loves film, tries to watch movies that he hasn't seen, I would highly recommend giving this a chance. It is a little bit long in the tooth. The pacing is, with silent films, as typical, can kind of get long in the tooth and a little bit redundant. But I think there's a lot of cool imagery, some cool story elements within it, and I think it's a good watch. So it was a nice little somewhat horror film to expose myself to in October, as this is my month of horror movie rewatches or watches for the first time. So let's check out Faust, and I had a really good time watching it.
It is crazy to think, this may be like a oversimplification, but like that we've had over 100 years of movies now, which like we were talking about like some early short films, like A Trip to the Moon, and then like Birth of a Nation, which I feel like is shown in every film class.
Yeah.
Just like 100 years of movies and how far we've come. How I wish we could go back sometimes to just like the simplicity.
It's like they
of
don't
things.
Make it like they did in the '80s or the '70s or the '60s.
Right. So
it's like, well, yeah, we just got Oppenheimer. That looks fucking insane. Right. Like, we just got Blade Runner 2049, and it's like, good movies are made all across time. Like, regardless of how old they are, there's good movies to be found and good things to be seen.
Yeah, definitely. What I want to check out for sure, just kind of after talking about it and just hearing your thoughts on it too. Definitely curious. A movie that I rewatched this week, you guys may have heard of it, The Avengers from 2012. My mom, actually, I mentioned earlier that I went over to her place this past weekend. She's been wanting to watch through the MCU. She actually came with me when I was 12 years old for my birthday to see the Avengers. She didn't know anything about
having May birthdays. I don't know if we brought this up. We're both born in May, but the MCU locking down late April, early May as like their prime release schedule for a lot of their big hitters. Getting the Avengers right around, well, May 4th or whatever it was.
Something like that.
Oh my god, seeing that in theaters around your birthday, awesome.
Incredible. Yeah, we had like Thunderbolts earlier this year, kind of around that time. So she had watched through all of Phase 1 except for the Avengers. She really liked Iron Man, really liked Captain America the First Avenger, which I'm like, yeah, those are the two like solid ones. I like Thor a lot from Phase 1.
Underrated, yeah.
But she wanted to kind of rewatch the Avengers. I think she fell asleep for part of it. That's fine. It's a longer movie, which that's fine. But I mean, I'm not going to spend too much time on the Avengers, but one thing that really did stick out to me is you obviously have the third act in New York. The battle in New York is awesome. It's so much fun. Seeing the Avengers, the circle shot of them teaming up is iconic. It's great. But the first two acts of this movie are a little bit slower. Like, it's the first act is kind of Loki getting the Tesseract and, you know, mind controlling Hawkeye and Selvig and everything. The middle act is pretty much on the helicarrier. And you get a lot of great setup for the future of the MCU while also being great for this movie, where you have like Cap and Iron Man kind of battling a little bit. Like, what does it mean to be a hero? What are you willing to sacrifice? Like, what are you willing to do? You get good stuff between Natasha and Hulk in this movie, kind of introducing that Age of Ultron storyline. And just a lot of great stuff with S.H.I.E.L.D. and Nick Fury. So a lot of things that, like, even though the movie's a bit slower in those moments than kind of what I remembered, it's still really engaging and I think holds up incredibly well. The movie looks incredible.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it is 13 years old, but it looks better than stuff that's coming out today a lot of times.
The CGI in the first Avengers, I feel like, holds up better through time than some of the stuff that we get in, like, Infinity War and Endgame. And I love those movies, but the CGI, especially with the Iron Man suit, the nanotech stuff in later iterations, that's kind of lost me a little bit. The look of it, like him jumping out of Avengers Tower in the suit forming around him, I'm like, that looks so good, like still.
Right, and I love the helicarrier sequence where it's like the Hulk is just tearing through shit and like Natasha and Thor are trying to stop him. And then you get Iron Man trying to like get the one of the engines back on. Cap is fighting people. It's really good stuff. So I think Joss Whedon did a great job with that movie and bringing these characters together, unlike anything we'd ever seen before at that time. Being in the theater watching that for the first time was unbelievable. Awesome. And
you saw it with your mom the first time you saw it in theaters?
Went to the Monticello Theater and saw it, and it was a truly like unbelievable experience. One of my favorite times in a movie theater for that.
Also one of my favorite experiences, but it was a bad viewing experience because I saw it at Buffalo Cinema, which has since been closed down for a while here. But it was our hometown theater, a relatively small theater. Like, we didn't have, like, exceptional sound quality or visual quality, but it was just our hometown
theater. So nostalgic.
It was so nostalgic. And the layout of that theater, the look of that theater, I love the Buffalo Cinema. It's been closed for so long, and I've even called the mayor. I'm like, can we, like, what's going on with it? Like, can we, like...
We should buy it someday.
If I had expendable income to where I'd be like, I'm buying a theater, I'm renovating it. Or, like, buy it, sell it to Imagine, which in the Midwest has been a really big theater company. Imagine did originally own it. We're getting into too much already. But I'd love to see that theater come back just because there's a lot of nostalgia there and a lot of love. I spent a lot of time there as a kid. But I saw Avengers in the very front row. This is, like, the first exposure I had to, like, big blockbuster movies coming out in the summer and everyone rushed to go see it. Because, like, Buffalo Cinema wasn't the theater where you pre-bought your tickets. It was you rush to the box office, you buy your ticket.
I miss that.
And you find a good seat.
I miss that.
And there's some of that excitement that I miss too. I sat, but the bullshit you have to deal with of that tactic or that technique of buying tickets is I sat in the absolute far front right corner of the film of the theater. So I had this like trapezoid view of it, and it was all just askewed and looked ridiculous on screen. And I sat there with my seventh grade girlfriend and her cousin as we watched that movie, and I was just like, this is
hell yeah.
This is love. This is life. This is everything. This is the secrets to the universe right here. I look at the Avengers as being like the Hulk movie that we never really could have fully got within the MCU. I do like the Incredible Hulk, but I love the way Joss Whedon handled the Hulk in his two Avengers films. What is your kind of like What is your Avengers scene? What is the scene that comes to mind when you think of Avengers, or your favorite scene from this movie? Not necessarily like the roundup, like, all right, Cap, you go to do this and you do that. What is like the scene for you?
Mm, that's a good question. There's a lot of really good stuff. I mean, I do really like the in Germany when they go there pretty early in the movie and they're trying to stop Loki from getting like this medal that they need. And, like, it's a couple of the Avengers, like, Captain America comes in, and, like, a guy in the crowd stands up, and he's like, we're not gonna stand down to people like you, and then Iron Man comes in with, like, AC/DC playing.
Yeah.
And it's, like, the first time we get that.
Like, converging.
And I'm like, this is fucking magic. But, you like, it's fun action, too. You get Loki doing some fun, like, he has a bunch of different versions of himself. I really like that. That scene is always kind of slept on. I feel like the first two acts are kind of slept on a little bit of this movie.
Because you get, like, the big battle of New York in the last act, and you get a little bit of Loki doing his shit, and everyone has, like, their big character moment. For me, I've always loved Samuel Jackson giving fucking grief to the, like, whatever the commanding team is, the people that we see in the shadows, the councils. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, I did, but since it was a stupid-ass decision, I decided to, or I like to do, ignore it. Yep. And I'm like, hell yeah, that's it. But honestly, Hulk tearing through the helicarrier, I love that mid-act two climactic action sequence that then lends to us having kind of a splintered team. Everyone's kind of scattered a little bit leading into that third act. I love the helicarrier work, and I'm like, I want to get back to like the helicarrier being a big thing within the MCU, which I know we've gone to space and stuff, has like the scope of the MCU has broadened and changed so much since then, so it's like, all right, the helicarrier is not so special anymore, and I loved that in the first movie.
Also, the Black Widow and Loki conversation.
Where she's
the red in her ledger, and like, I feel like that again, like, kind of setting up for future MCU stuff, like her, you know, in Avengers Endgame, like, clearing out the red in her ledger. Like, that sets everything up so well, and it's just too, like, Loki's such a good villain in this movie, too.
That and Coulson's death, and how Fury flips that into being motivation of, like, hey, Coulson believed in something. He throws those bloody cards on the table, and, like, you get that shot of Robert Downey Jr., like, standing up and, like, walking out, and it's just, like, And then Kobe Smulders coming and being like, those were in his locker. And he's like, sometimes you gotta do the things you need to do to motivate the right people. And I'm like, I love Nick Fury being kind of shady, but like doing things for the right purpose. So like, we need to have maybe an MCU specific episode where we talk about maybe our favorite MCU film. Mine isn't necessarily the Avengers, but a lot of the best things in the MCU comes from that first Avengers. So I think we need to maybe have a sit down and just like an hour long episode of just us talking about why we love the MCU, why we don't like current MCU maybe, but focusing on what is our favorite MCU film. Because 100%. I think there's a lot of knocks on it, like not being cinema or not being like, it's just being too commercial, pop culture buzz, like filmmaking, whatever. Whatever knock you can kind of levy against the MCU, sure, fine. If you're that pissed off about it, fine. Have your fucking things to get mad about. Whatever. I disagree with it. Doesn't matter. But I think there's a lot of great things that at least we got to grow up with the MCU, so there's a lot of nostalgia.
Very special.
There. Yeah, it's a special thing. Moving into current superhero world in terms of projects coming out, TV shows and movies, we did have the 7th episode of Season 2 of Peacemaker. A show that I think you and I were still massively in the positive on, but there's just like half things, like half measures of like, well, this could be changed. You're falling short on this, or this is kind of grating on me. Judo Master, why the fuck are you still on this show? Like, there's things that have kind of rubbed us all the wrong way in Season 2, but overall, we're still pretty big fans of it. We did get Episode 7, which is the penultimate episode of Season 2, so we have one more left to go later on this week. I really dug this episode, but once we get into conversation, it's going to sound like I'm going to dog on this episode, because there are things in this episode that bother me and have been kind of little small issues that have crept up and gradually grown throughout this season for me. But overall, I enjoy this episode. It was too short, 33 minutes, HBO Max, Disney Plus, any streaming service that's in charge of handling original content or original TV series. Give us a full fucking hour, or don't give us an episode. That's my take. But still like this episode, 33 minutes. Corey, what was your take? What was your anticipation for the 7th episode? I know we had a lot of cameo talk, potentially, of these latter few episodes. What was your reaction to episode 7?
We sure did have a cameo. Spoiler alert Peacemaker season 2 episode 7. If you don't want to know, you guys remember Stanley Happerson? Probably not.
Ball cut, big glasses, mustache.
Probably not from the Superman movie. One of the people in the Lex Luthor room that was punching in 1A or whatever the fuck. One of the guys that...
Fuck you, Superman!
Oh, God! Damn it!
One of the guys controlling the board thing. That was the big cameo for this episode, I guess. The post-credits scene with him is really funny. I was going to show you it before this. Because you missed it, but I'll show you after because it's hilarious, actually. I really like it. But it's funny because, like... We wrapped up talking about Alien Earth last week, and which I think that show started off really strong and ended kind of meh.
Yeah.
I think Peacemaker season 2 started off kind of meh and has gotten to more of what I've wanted from this season, but...
Is it too late?
I think it is a little bit too late. I think that I've wanted to be in Earth X or Earth 2. They've kind of said a couple different names, but this Nazi other dimension, and this honestly was the most, like... impressive stuff in this episode. The thing that stood out to me the most was Augie's character, played by Robert Patrick, his dad in this other dimension. And there's the scene at the end where they have Peacemaker and the 11th Street kids all there in the house, and you know, Harcourt's like, how can you, you're like, you're all fucking Nazis, this is insane the world you're in. And Augie's like, I'm not a Nazi, I don't agree with what they're doing. He's like, cheers to you if you can fight all of the injustices in your world. But, like, I'm going to fight the monsters and the bad people that I can here.
That are
in front of me that I don't even necessarily, you know, I don't agree with everything else. I don't like the cops here. That's kind of a, like, shocking scene in this episode when he's mowing down the cops.
Oh, yeah.
And you're like, whoa.
I thought you were a good guy. Like, you're the top trio.
But then he's like, no, the cops here are, like, controlled by Nazis and everything. Which, like, yeah, that makes sense and whatever. They have those ideologies. So... that was my favorite part, and it kind of gets undermined a little bit by Vigilante coming in and doing a James Gunn joke of killing him. That's whatever. Yeah. But the scene with you know, Robert Patrick delivering that, I'm like, that's interesting just as a comparison to the Augie that we had from the first season.
Where he's just outright, downright
just bad. A white supremacist.
He's the worst. Yeah.
So I thought that was really strong. I really like... John Cena's performance in this episode.
Yeah.
Him when, you know, they're all kind of tagging up on Keith, kind of a like Thanos moment from Infinity War where they're all just grabbing a part of him. And John Cena just like screams, he's like, get off him. And he's just like cradling him and he's like, everybody, it doesn't matter which dimension I'm in, like everybody around me gets hurt. It was great stuff and I really liked it. Also really enjoyed just a small moment on earlier in the episode when Peacemaker is on the motorcycle with Harcourt, and she just kind of, like, rests her head on him. It was just, like, a very sweet moment of, like, they're getting chased by the cops in that moment, but she just, like, feels safe with him.
Yeah, she's just like, I'm not sure if I'm going to get this moment again, so, like...
So, a lot of really good stuff in this episode. I liked a lot of it, but like you said, we're kind of out of this dimension now, at least seemingly, into the last episode that we've only spent like maybe 2.5 episodes of an 8-episode season in this dimension, which I think is interesting and you could have done a lot more.
Also, it's maybe the main conflict of the show.
Yeah.
We're only getting 2.5 episodes in it. It's like, I feel like you guys misaligned this season a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Still good. Still very curious to see what they do with an hour finale next week or like 50 minutes, whatever. So... a lot of positives still, but I'm going to need, kind of like Alien Earth, I'm going to need that last episode to just, like, look at the season as a whole. We'll have a full breakdown next week of you know, where we were, if those first episodes were worth it. Maybe it'll reframe some of that. Who knows? But a good episode. Curious for next week.
Yeah, it's been frustrating going into HBO Max, and then every episode's been, like, 35, 33, like, in the 30s, and it's like, I want more time, not only with these characters, but in this... other Earth, Earth X. I want to figure out what's going on here. And we talked about also, it feels too slapsticky sometimes. The humor doesn't really line up in terms of, oh, you didn't notice the big Adolf Hitler fucking mural on the side of this building that we're like, we're in this room. There he is. And he's like, oh, I didn't see that. It's just humor that doesn't really align with this show sometimes, or doesn't align what I've come to like really expect from James Gunn humor. Overall, I really like this episode, but I feel like, again, it's rushed. Why the fuck is Judo Master still a character? He doesn't matter. This is the episode, and I'm saying that as this is the episode I've liked Judo Master the most in, but I'm still, his humor doesn't work. I don't think this character matters. Take him out. How is Danielle Brooks outrunning a crowd of people chasing after her? I'm not going to be a fat shamer. I'm not going to say anything like that. But, hey, Danielle Brooks, you're not in, like, peak athletic health. Sorry, that if that's, like, a controversial thing to say. She can't outrun all of these people. And the way that this show tries to edit around it in a similar way as to way, or how they edited around Leia escaping those two goons and Obi-Wan Kenobi and being able to always be out of reach. And it's like, there's a shot where there's guys almost putting their hands on the back of your shirt, and then the next shot, seconds later, they're way down the fucking street. What's going on? And, like, it's just, it's simple things where I'm like, you guys can tighten this up. Like, I know you know how to do this. Like, Jesus Christ, fucking iron this out. So there's little idiosyncrasies of shit like that that piss me off. And that kind of grows. And then this episode's only 33 minutes. Fuck, okay, fine, why not? I wait a week to watch this show on a streaming service where I pay, what, $18 a month to only watch a half an hour? Fuck you, make it an hour. You can also give us more time in Earth X. I feel like they had so many, like, good ideas of, like, oh, let's bring in this Earth X. It's going to be a good conflict because it's going to hold a mirror up to, like, our own worlds and juxtapose what our beliefs are versus this Nazi America. Oh, wow, have big opinions. Fine, cool, do that. But I feel like you didn't have enough to back it up to give us a full fucking episode. The conflict in this episode resolves way too quick, gets us to a point where Robert Patrick is having a phenomenal monologue. But as someone who's a James Gunn fan, his comedy gets in the way here, and we have Vigilante storming through the glass, stabbing Robert Patrick in the neck, and we're finally getting a poignant moment, and now we're just, people are dying. Vigilante's doing something funny. Oh, wow, stab him in the neck. Okay. I get it, but also just let a fucking moment breathe. Mm-hmm. It's okay for something to be serious for a little bit longer. And then we get into the ending where Keith, in that big kind of scrap down, tear down fight before they switch portals or switch dimensions and they leave. And I will say, I really love the Harcourt. Give me your gun. I'm going to kill him. Mm-hmm. We can't have him coming after Chris. Give me the gun. I'm going to kill him. I love that idea. I like how it's resolved and how it's left off. I don't love the blocking of that scene. It felt very clumsy, and it felt like they didn't naturally know how to get, like, all right, we want Harcourt to make like she's going to shoot Keith, but we can't have her shoot Keith. So how can we get that, how can we get out of the situation that we're trying to propose? And it just felt so sloppy in execution that I was like, okay, there's many a times where she could have just domed this fucker, and now she's just thrown out of the room, thrown out of the dimension, now she's back in her own dimension. Okay, whatever, fine. It felt like conveniences, it felt like they didn't have enough story, it felt like the conflict wrapped up too quick, and it felt like an over-reliance on comedy when there are times where this show has proven that they can handle emotional weight and resonance very well, especially to give this episode its flowers, that amazing John Cena moment, which he's not the best actor in the world, but he delivers this moment perfectly of, like, what are we doing? What the fuck are we doing here? And I was just like, hell yeah. Mm-hmm. Good job. Yeah. This is great. And this is coming. I liked this episode. I still think, like, this could have easily been a great episode. It's just they're making decisions that go against it becoming a great episode. So I like Peacemaker Season 2 a lot. I love the first season. I don't think Season 2 has really held up to a lot of my love for that first season. Still a good ride. I think that there are easy things that they could iron out. I have no idea what the fuck's going to come in this last episode. I don't know where we're going. Aside from, well, what's the name of the Luther guy that was going to flood the
Sydney keyboard?
Sydney Haberson. He's gonna come in the next episode. But in this next episode, what do we have to do? Like, resolve, like, John Cena or Christopher Smith gets arrested by Argus, or
I was telling you, like, I hope we don't do, like, Man of Tomorrow setup in this last episode.
I don't need that either.
I don't want that. I want Peacemaker to be its own thing, and it's where I get a little bit worried with the DCU having a lot, kind of doing what the MCU did in its later part, where it's like, we have to connect everything. Now, where it's like, the early MCU did that in very small doses of a post-credits scene, right? Where it's like, we had Nick Fury show up at the end of Iron Man. It doesn't affect the movie of Iron Man at all. It's his story. So I hope that next week is centered around Peacemaker, and Harcourt, I feel like, needs to kind of be a central character there. So
I need to have a good idea as to where their relationship is now at the end of this, which I don't think is going to take the most amount of cleanup or a lot of like narrative time, especially with it being potentially an hour-long finale. But it's just like, how do we resolve this aspect of the story? Like, how do we clean this up? But, yeah. Still a lot to come. I'm still very excited for this last episode, even though I perhaps probably dogged on this episode maybe a bit too much. I still like it, but it frustrated me. Also, big surprise, I am becoming a little bit more of the TV watcher out of the two of us.
Let's go!
Which I don't love. Yay. I prefer movies, but I've been watching a lot of TV mostly because my wife at the end of the night is like, let's watch this hour-long thing as opposed to Mason thumbing through a lot of streaming services or thumbing through his shelves and trying to find a movie that he really wants to watch and spending 2 hours on deciding. Let's just watch an hour-long episode of a show that we're watching. So we did resolve and finish off season two of Wednesday. My quick thoughts, it's not that good. It feels like an ABC Family show. If ABC Family shows were still coming out with hot new originals on cable television, it's nothing special. It feels like something a middle schooler would have written and really liked. I didn't really love it. It feels like a retread of a lot of stuff from the first season. If you liked it, maybe visit it. I don't know. It's just, it's nothing to me. I don't care. Jenna Ortega, there's only a finite amount of time before I'm like, you're too old for this Wednesday character. I like the Addams Family. I like those characters. John Leguizamo, not John Leguizamo, Luis Guzman. I don't know why I confused John Leguizamo.
Luis, crazy word.
Not even at all look like each other. Luis Guzman as Gomez is perfect casting for me. Aside from that, I don't really love this show or care about it. I'm happy that I finished it so I can move off of it. My wife and I did then end up starting The Haunting of Bly Manor, which is a show made by Mike Flanagan with his like Haunting of Hill House, Midnight Mass, The Midnight Club, The Fall of the House of Usher, all of his Netflix original shows that he's been doing. I started this a long time ago, and then I just never continued on with it because I didn't really get hooked by it. My wife loves this show, so this October I told her I'd be willing to sit down and watch it with her because we've watched all of the other Mike Flanagan shows together. So far, we are halfway through it's a limited series, so halfway through the show so far, and I do dig it, and I'm excited to kind of continue throughout that. By the end of this week, I will be able to kind of give you a full report on what I thought of it. I do love Mike Flanagan's work. If you haven't watched Midnight Mass, I think that's his best work he's ever done, movie or TV. And then Twin Peaks, I'm still plugging away on that. I'm over halfway through season two, which I've gotten the reveal as to who is the killer of Laura Palmer, which I already knew that. It was just more of letting the story get there naturally. It was something that was I kind of had spoiled for me as being a film fan or TV fan as well. I still really like the show. It's such a fun David Lynch, Mark Frost soap opera of the small town. There's weird thriller aspects. There's weird mystery aspects. There's also just like weird small town isms that feels very Coen Brothers to me at times. But I will say, after having that reveal of who killed Laura Palmer, it does feel, and I told this to Corey, it feels like when you play a video game and you finish that main story, the main plot, like in Red Dead Redemption or Saints Row or Grand Theft Auto or Skyrim, you finish that main story. Cool. But then you want 100% the story or 100% that game, so you go back and complete the side quests. That's how season two, or at least this latter half of season two of Twin Peaks feels. It feels like I completed the main story, but I have like these weird random side quests that I'm going on that I don't hate because I really like these characters. There are some characters I would do away with. I don't need James. He's not interesting. I don't need Catherine back in the show. Why the fuck is she back? But overall, I'm spending time with a lot of characters that I'm enjoying. So I'm really excited to see where this season ends because I've heard the final episode of season two is really good, and I'm really excited to watch the prequel, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, which is directed by David Lynch. So hopefully I'll be able to finish season two and watch that prequel in this upcoming week and give you a report on that. But Twin Peaks has been a really great show to watch, especially this past September, October. It really has fit that vibe. So I'd really recommend it to you, Corey. And also I'd recommend Haunting of Bly Manor. You could skip Wednesday. You don't need to touch Wednesday. It's fine. Mm-hmm. Haunting of Bly Manor, if you haven't seen it, I don't know what experience or what exposure you've had with Mike Flanagan's Netflix work. I would say watch just about any of those except for maybe The Midnight Club, and you'd have a good time. And The Twin Peaks Show. It's great so far. I really liked it.
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of that stuff, so I definitely would check it out during the season for sure. Coming out this week, pretty busy release. We're kind of getting into... We have some bigger releases, but then a lot of award season stuff kind of coming out. The main thing is Tron Ares. This is the third Tron movie after the original one, and then Tron Legacy. And it's from Joachim Ronin, who did, for me, I guess, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales.
Yeah.
It's just fine. It's whatever. But we got Evan Peters, Jeff Bridges is coming back, Greta Lee, Jared Leto, Gillian Anderson, Cameron Monaghan. So pretty good cast here. But there's a new program called Ares that's sent from the digital world to the real world. And I've dug the trailers. I've dug the posters for this movie. I like the little bits of the score I've gotten from Nine Inch Nails. I'm excited to kind of listen
to that at the gym.
Yeah, I'm excited to like listen through the full score. I want to wait until after the movie comes out to listen to the full score. But I've not seen the original Tron movie, so I'm going to watch that this week. I really like Tron Legacy. I'm excited to rewatch that because it's been a long time. So this one looks really cool. I'm excited to see it. I think bringing it into the real world is a nice way to continue this franchise a bit. And this has the potential to be the best Tron movie, I think. So, very excited. I will be seeing this one for sure this week.
Yeah, that is the Thursday night viewing, if there is one for this week. I'm really excited for Tron Ares. I don't have the most, like, expectations just because I haven't seen a lot of work from this director. I do like Tron Legacy, and I think the original Tron, it holds up pretty well. It's a fun movie. We also have Roofman coming out, directed by Derek Cian France, who is the director of The Place Beyond the Pines, as well as Blue Valentine. So a little bit of a diverse filmography with a lot of Ryan Gosling films. But this is the film starring Channing Tatum, Kristen Dunst, and Lakeith Stanfield. It's about a charismatic criminal, and it's also based on a true story of a man who was able to... He recognizes things, he sees things, he's very smart and intuitive on things, so he's able to escape prison and hold up in this Toys R Us and try and hide out from the cops while the heat dies down. So I'm really excited to see this. I've seen the trailer, I think, for this maybe like 5 times in the past week. Every time I go to a movie, it's like they double up and show it to me twice, I feel like. But it's a trailer for a movie that I like the trailer, I like the director, I like the cast. I'm pretty sold on it. It seems like a pretty good little like drama. Mm-hmm. It feels like a good like middle of the road budget movie that we don't typically get a lot in theaters. And I like the cast, and I've heard really great things about Channing Tatum and Kirsten Dunst in this movie, so I'm really excited to see it. And I'm really kind of excited for a good little drama thriller in theaters. Corey, please ramble on for as long as you can about this next one, because I am gonna go piss.
Right on. I'm gonna kick through. I'm actually just gonna mention the next four here.
Sounds great.
We have a lot of award season movies coming out. Like I mentioned, it's kind of getting into October. First one up is Anemone, which is directed by Ronan Day-Lewis, which is the son of Daniel Day-Lewis. Daniel Day-Lewis kind of making his comeback to acting here, and it's getting a lot of hype for him maybe getting a nomination. The movie stars Daniel Day-Lewis and Sean Bean, and it takes place in Northern Ireland, where a man heads out on a journey into the woods to reconnect with his estranged hermit brother, who he has a complicated past with. That happened decades ago. So I'm actually going to try and see this one tomorrow, I think. I've heard middling things about it, but I am excited to see this one. I think it has, you know, obviously a great actor in Daniel Day-Lewis, which I'm excited to see him come back. And his son directing the movie is pretty interesting, too. Another one is the movie called If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, which is one of the most interesting titles that I've seen for a movie in a long time. It's directed by Mary Bronstein, starring Rose Byrne. And Rose Byrne, her life is crashing around her, and she's trying to navigate a multitude of things, including her child's illness, her absent husband, a missing person, and a hostile relationship with her therapist. I've seen the trailer a couple times, and it looks really interesting. I believe it's A24, and I like Rose Byrne a lot. I think she's a very underrated actress. I love anytime she pops up in something, you know, like Bridesmaids or the Neighbors movies, I think are a lot of fun. So this one would be cool to see her, if she is, you know, kind of living up to the hype of this movie. Getting nominated for an Oscar would be great. The other one coming out in limited release this week is A House of Dynamite, which is coming to Netflix on October 24th, coming to theaters for a small time, coming from Kathryn Bigelow. You got a great cast, including Idris Elba and Rebecca Ferguson, and a missile is launched at the United States, and the White House is trying to figure out how to stop this missile. That sounds awesome. I love those contained kind of thrillers in these rooms here. Almost like a September 5th movie from last year, where it's like, seems like it's taking
September 5th?
Yeah, fuck off. How do you say it? When's your birthday?
Okay.
When
May 8th.
Yeah, fuck you.
May 8th.
I'm excited for this movie. I don't know if it'll be in the Oscar conversation a lot, but it just seems like a really good thriller. And then a movie that I don't really know that much about, but Kiss of the Spider Woman, which is a remake of a 1985 movie that got William Hurt a Best Actor win, nominated for Best Picture, Director, and Screenplay. And this new version is directed by Bill Condon, who did Dreamgirls, a couple of the Twilight movies, and the live-action Beauty and the Beast. Stars Diego Luna and Jennifer Lopez, along with Tanatua, I think I'm saying that right. Some of these performances are getting Oscar buzz, but essentially, the movie follows Valentin, who is a political prisoner who is sharing a cell with a character named Melina, and they kind of form an unlikely bond, and they recount a Hollywood musical plot. And I'm confused about what this movie is. I haven't seen the original movie, but I'm curious to watch it. But it is getting some of that kind of award season buzz too. So a lot of interesting movies coming out this week. Like I said, I'm going to try and see Anemone tomorrow, and then A House of Dynamite for sure. I'm very excited for that one.
Yeah, Anemone is probably... I was going to try and check it out. I was going to do a double feature of Smash Machine and Anemone, and then Smash Machine kind of upset me and disappointed me, so I was like, no, I'm not in the mood for another two-hour-long drama that I'm only really going to see because of the performances, or at least the performance of Daniel Day-Lewis, which is similar to kind of what I feel like I heard about the Smash Machine before I saw it. So I'm going to try and check out Anemone this week, and then I will also be looking to see House of Dynamite in theaters just because I'm really excited to see a Catherine Bigelow film in theaters again. I do believe I saw Zero Dark Thirty in theaters when I was like 11, but I didn't see Detroit in theaters, which I was happy to watch that movie by myself at home and be really sad and upset by myself as opposed to seeing that in theaters. I'm not the most in the know on Kiss of the Spider Woman. I know Diego Luna's in it, and that was all I knew kind of going into that. I didn't know it was coming out this week. But I don't know, there's a good kind of like broad spanning release schedule that we have this week. Tron: Ares obviously is gonna be the first one that I'm gonna go see. Roofman I'm interested in, and then Anemone and House of Dynamite. So it could be kind of a sneaky busy week at the theaters for us. In terms of physical media roundup, I didn't look to purchase anything. I will say that Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me Criterion Blu-ray, might be looking to get that here in the coming weeks just as I wrap up season two and then eventually watch that one movie that's the entry within this franchise. So I'm really excited for that. But I did get an update. The Fantastic Four steelbook that I ordered is coming on October 14th, even though the release date of that steelbook is like this Tuesday. So I was like, fuck.
All right.
Okay, I'm going to have to wait a while. All right.
We have to bring it over. I want to see that definitely smell when you get it. Yeah, smell it. Give it a little sniff.
Good sniff.
Yep.
Strictly because of Vanessa Kirby.
That's 100%. And Paul Walter Hauser. spread it on. Come on. Spread it on. That shit's so funny.
Flare me up.
Well, you mentioned already coming out this week, there is a 4K Criterion coming out for the Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me movie. It also has the Blu-ray of the Missing Pieces kind of movie in there included, so that's coming out. There are quite a few new releases coming out this week. We have Honey Don't, which actually came out, I think today it is, like a couple days before Tuesday. And then we have a lot of big stuff. So F1 the movie coming out, nice steelbook for that, which I think you already pre-ordered. Nobody 2, The Bad Guys 2, I Know What You Did Last Summer, the 2025 remake, or continuation, whatever you want. The steelbook, very nice. The 4K steelbook is actually really like the design of that. Then we have a few smaller movies, Dangerous Animals, Guns Up, The Last Rodeo, and then there's some library titles coming out. The Quick and the Dead 4K, which I actually think I'm going to watch either this week or next week. I've kind of teased it as like my Q movie I'm going to watch, so interesting that it's coming out this week. Labyrinth and the Dark Crystal on 4K, Rocky Horror Picture Show on 4K, Lights Out, underrated horror movie. Watch that this Halloween season. It's really, really good.
Very good.
Yeah, so a lot of big stuff coming out this week. I'm excited for it. F1 is kind of the movie that I definitely want to buy of this new batch of movies.
Yeah, like I said, the Fire Walk With Me. We were talking earlier, too, before we start recording about Twin Peaks, and I think I might need to sit down and watch The Missing Pieces. That's kind of like the caveat of like all these deleted scenes within this world that you don't necessarily, the way it's been explained to me or I've seen, it's not required viewing, but it's just padding out the extended universe of Twin Peaks. So fuck it, maybe I'll have to watch that too, so I might have to check that off the list, but I am really excited to see that film. I've never seen Rocky Horror Picture Show.
I haven't either.
And it's something that I added to, I have an ongoing list of movies I want to watch in October, both new movies to me and movies I've seen before, so I obviously have like a lot of the Halloween films on there and Halloween Town and stuff like that, but Rocky Horror Picture Show is one of those movies that I really want to check off my list this upcoming October and get that finally seen, and maybe if I like it enough, I'll buy it and collect that as well. So who knows? Maybe I'll check out that that 4K release. Moving into movie news this past week, kind of weird, surprising news. There wasn't a whole lot, but we did get an announcement of a Macho Man Randy Savage biopic coming from Kenan Thompson and Johnny Ryan Jr.'s Artists for Artists will be developing the biopic, and it's based on a script by Savage's late brother, Lanny Poffo.
Yeah, I don't know much about Macho Man Randy Savage besides the voice.
Yeah.
But it could be fun. Big news for our friend Heidi.
I immediately thought of Heidi when I saw this.
We're getting a sequel to the Simpsons movie, which the original came out in 2007. This movie's coming out in July of 2027. And, you know, I have never seen The Simpsons or The Simpsons movie.
Whoa!
I've never watched a complete episode of The Simpsons. I'm, like, very aware of it, obviously. Could you not be? I'm absolutely going to watch the movie before this one comes out. Our friend Heidi's favorite part of the original movie is the spider pig on the ceiling. She quotes that. It's hilarious. She loves that movie so much. I'm excited for her. I'm excited for Simpsons fans, and, you know, it's just kind of a daunting thing to get into, because if I start something and, like, I want to finish it, I'm like, fuck, that's a lot of stuff to watch. I'm aware of all of, like, the big things that happen, but exciting for our friend Heidi.
Yeah. I know you'll check out the movie, which is literally kind of the extent as to my exposure to The Simpsons, so check that out, because I think the Simpsons movie is pretty funny, and I've seen a couple of shows whenever it's been on TV, whenever I wasn't, like, planning on watching The Simpsons, it pops up, but the first movie is pretty funny. I'm excited about a second one. We also got news that Luke Wilson will be joining Will Ferrell in a Netflix upcoming untitled golf comedy series. It's a 10-episode show that will follow a fictional golf legend named Lonnie the Hawk Hawkins. A little bit of an old school kind of reunion between Luke Wilson and Will Ferrell, which I'm really excited because I do love Luke Wilson and Will Ferrell together, and I love old school. So not that I was like chomping at the bits for a Netflix comedy with Will Ferrell, but you know, this little vote of confidence, maybe I'll have to check this out whenever it releases.
Yeah, I love golf, so you know, it could be fun little Happy Gilmore-esque type show. A couple of cast updates for some movies coming out. We had Jeremy Irons join the cast of Highlander, the remake that's coming out with Henry Cavill starring in the lead role, and then we had Aldous Hodge and Dave Bautista join the cast of Roadhouse 2. You know, Guy Ritchie was going to direct the movie. I forget if somebody else hopped on as the director. I thought we maybe mentioned it before. Aldous Hodge, I think, is a really good actor. He was very good in One Night in Miami. Also as Hawkman in Black Adam. I really liked him. So, just a couple updates there for a couple movies I'm very curious about. More excited for Highlander than Roadhouse 2. Roadhouse 2, I don't really think we need.
No, I don't really. I was really only excited about Roadhouse 2 when Guy Ritchie was attached. It now looks like it's Ilya Naishuller,
who I believe
is the director. Was it of Nobody?
Director
of Nobody, Hardcore Henry. I really like Hardcore Henry. I completely missed that announcement that he was going to be attached to directing this follow up, which that's a good director for this type of movie. Maybe I will check this out. Hopefully, whenever they do release it, goes to theaters and not straight to streaming. In terms of other news, we did get a development for a lot of people in our friend group, I feel like, that love Peaky Blinders. And I'm not saying I don't love it. I love the idea of it. I just haven't sat down and watched it. And it's one of those shows where people are like, you need to see it. This is one of the ones where I'm like, I know, I'm sorry. I will check it out. But Peaky Blinders is looking to return with two new 6-episode sequel series from creator Stephen Knight. Stephen Knight being obviously the original creator of Peaky Blinders. He's also the writer and director of one of my favorite films of all time, Lock, starring Tom Hardy. But these two sequel series will be following the upcoming feature film that is also just, I believe, wrapped production. Cillian Murphy is also attached to be the executive producer. And the series will air on BBC One in the UK and Netflix globally. So, honestly, with the movie coming out, with these two new sequel series also ramping up production, It's more put the like fire, like pedal to the metal. I need to sit down and watch all of Peaky Blinders. I believe it's what, 5-6 seasons maybe. Everyone I know that's watched it, they fucking quote it. They talk Peaky Blinders, like they talk that way. They know it, and everything I've heard has been just glowingly positive. And I also know that Tom Hardy plays a character named Alfie Salmons, who I'm really excited to see in that show. So I will need to sit down after I finish kind of the watch through of a lot of the shows that I'm working on, but I will need to watch Peaky Blinders in preparation.
This is the next big show that's kind of on my list. I'm trying to work through some more critically acclaimed or classic shows. I did that with Succession earlier this year, late last year. So Peaky Blinders kind of leading up to the movie. I'm absolutely going to watch that. Mm-hmm. I'm excited for the sequel series. I just feel like it's something I'm going to really enjoy. Yeah. So pumped for that. Last little bit of news is that if you're a fan of the Kill Bill movies, we're getting a Kill Bill The Whole Bloody Affair, which is both movies cut together in one movie, and it's getting a theatrical release in some places, 35 and 70 millimeter, coming out on December 5th. Very excited for it. I've actually never seen this cut of the movie. Yeah. I think it got a Blu-ray release a little while back, but I've only seen both movies individually. Curious to see how they're merged together, just kind of that middle point.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm pumped for this. I mean, I haven't watched the Kill Bill movies in a while, actually. So be very happy to go see these in a theater to kind of fill that Tarantino void of him not putting out a new movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I might have to check this out in theaters as well. I love Kill Bill Volume 1. I despise Kill Bill Volume 2. I think that is my definitive, like, least favorite Quentin Tarantino film.
Whoa.
By far and away. I like Death Proof a lot, especially compared to Kill Bill Volume 2. I will say the balance of those two films, I would see how that would kind of elevate Kill Bill Volume 2 to being a better film than I think it is by itself, by being that second part. So I'll happily check out this in theaters, and maybe I'll have a more in-depth appreciation of that second half of that story. But anyways, we have a good remainder of Football Sunday to get to, and I know my Chargers will be hopefully not choking against the Commanders like they did against Jackson Dart last week. So thanks for joining us for another episode of Slate Night, the Film Fan Podcast. Be sure to follow us on Instagram, TikTok for more in-depth movie reviews and movie news. Give us a suggestion if you think we're fucking up on anything. We probably are, but we might change it. Who knows? We'll see. In the world of film, it's not just about what's on screen. It's about also who's next to you in the theater.
From Mason and I at Slate Night, that's a wrap.